This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Carly Huckles.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. Across the Rocky Mountains, historical artifacts tower over the landscape, but you might not even notice them because they're trees.
This is real. It places our footprint on the landscape as Ute people, as a tribe.
We'll hear why archaeologists are racing to document them before they run out of time.
Then we'll hear how many Western rivers are stressed out because of things like drought, pollution, and runoff from wildfires. But one river in particular is taking a beating this summer.
Certainly the Animas is a bit of a poster child for some of the issues that plague rivers around the Western United States.
This river in southwestern Colorado can teach us a lot about waterways throughout the West.
And while it used to be known more for its illicit roots, street art has found its way out of the shadows. We'll learn more and take an audio tour of some of the best in Denver.
Plus, Howie Moshevitz checks in from the Telluride Film Festival. But first, summer is over and most kids are back in school. At the beginning of the summer, we asked teachers through our Curious Colorado webpage about what they were going to do over their summer break. We heard from educators around northern Colorado, including Ben Brown, who submitted this audio essay about the passion project he turned into a business.
Over my summer break, I launched a business. The last bell of the school year rang. I watched students stream out of the school, excited about what summer will bring. Their excitement is always so infectious. I packed up my classroom, I completed my end-of-year checklist, high-fived my colleagues, and then headed out of the building myself. If you ever hear teachers say that they don't like summer break, I think they're lying. I love summer. Last summer began with a week decompressing with the family in Fruta, Colorado. We rode some bikes, hung out at the pool, and watched my son run through the sprinklers. The official beginning of summer. While soaking up the sun, I began to have an idea. Thoughts filled my head as I sat on the porch. Well, where do the teachers in Fruta go in the summer? Are they traveling to the mountains? My house in Summit is sitting empty. Is their house here empty? So an idea began to spring up in my head. Teachers love to travel. They have similar school breaks. They have similar values. Wouldn't it be great to be able to share their homes and travel anywhere? I was inspired. After a week of relaxing, I returned to Dillon with my new idea in hand. Between corn on the cob, watermelon, and a couple s'mores, I brought together a group of fellow teachers and we started to work on my idea. We used the design thinking process that I teach my students. We brought together focus groups, we built marketing plans, talked to some more teachers, we made prototypes, we tested until finally we were able to launch a website that we call teacherhomeswap.com. It's similar to an Airbnb or VRBO, but it's for verified teachers only, and we built it for a teacher's salary. We figured that sharing or renting homes with other teachers means less money spent on lodging or accommodations, which helps us stretch our teacher's salary for maximum fun. Now it's been a year later. This summer brought some new challenges and opportunities. The site is up and running, but it needed something more for us to meet the needs of the teachers. Our first website design wasn't exactly what we had hoped for. So in this new version, we changed almost everything about the look and feel. I wouldn't say the first one was a failure, but it wasn't exactly what we were looking for, so it required a redesign. I tell my students often that iteration is the key to the design process. We need to constantly revisit and improve our ideas. So that was our plan for this summer. I focused on allowing teachers to browse the homes on the site. I wanted them to choose whether or not they wanted to rent or swap homes, and I wanted to increase our visibility on Facebook. As with any new project, the learning process is challenging. Optimism can be blanketed by failure, and patience is a necessity. So whenever I become impatient or languish in my ideas, I remember how I explain the learning process to my students. Be kind, work hard, make good choices. Oh yeah, and don't be afraid to take a risk. So after this summer's endeavors, Teacher Home Swap now has over 70 homes. We even have homes in places like California, Florida, Idaho, one in Holland, and we have almost 500 verified members. So it's going well. The project combines my commitment to the teaching community with my excitement for travel. We have yet to make any money with Teacher Home Swap. We're really looking to build the community, as I love the idea of connecting teachers to each other around the world and saving them some money in the process. So I wouldn't really call this a second job as much as a passion project. Working on my business with other teachers has been an amazing experience. However, I can't wait to get back to my classroom, can't wait to get back to my students, I want to hear their stories from the summer. Just as they inspire me to take risks, I want to inspire them to take a risk to learn something new each day.
That was Ben Brown. He's a sixth grade science and design thinking teacher in Summit County. His essay was produced by KUNC's Stephanie Daniel. You can find more of her stories at KUNC.org. My least favorite part of back to school season is the traffic.
Oh man, I know what you mean, but you know what? Calm down the road rage because it's going to get worse.
Oh no.
In northern Colorado, construction on the North I-25 Express Lanes project has begun. KUNC's Matt Bloom has more on potential traffic impacts.
Drivers shouldn't worry too much, at least for now. Crews will start by permanently closing a minor frontage road between the Budweiser Events Center in Loveland and the Highway 392 exit. Jared File with the Colorado Department of Transportation says it's preparation for more work to come.
So this is all part of getting ready for the expansion, which will really begin in earnest on the evening of September 9th.
An official groundbreaking ceremony is scheduled for the 10th. CDOT's effort to add a tolled express lane to the increasingly clogged stretch of highway between Fort Collins and Johnstown is scheduled to last until late 2021. Matt Bloom, KUNC.
Almost a quarter of households in rural Colorado lack access to broadband internet. As a part of a new program, the U.S. Department of Agriculture is taking steps to close the broadband gap in rural communities across the country, and it's seeking input from residents. Tony Neal Graves directs Colorado's broadband office.
It's kind of two aspects to broadband. One is, do you even have a pipe coming into that community? And once you get that big pipe into the community, do you have that last mile, you know, to provide service to homes and businesses? And so we're trying to address both of those issues.
Neal Graves says in Colorado, the money will supplement funds that are available through the state. The USDA is taking feedback just for a little bit, though, through Monday, September 10th. You can do that on their website, usda.gov/broadband.
It has been a rough summer for most Western rivers. Drought conditions are pervasive throughout the region and in some places still getting worse. One tributary within the Colorado River watershed has been hit hard on a few fronts over the last few years. And as KUNC's Luke Runyon reports, it might have finally hit rock bottom.
3 years ago, Barb Horn stood along the banks of the Animas River in the city of Durango, Colorado. She was watching the usually clear water change color.
It was absolutely surreal, and I think that's why it went viral. It's like somebody photoshopped the river orange.
Upstream, Environmental Protection Agency workers and a contractor triggered the spill of 3 million gallons of rust-colored mine waste while cleaning up the Gold King mine.
If you're a Harry Potter fan, it looked like butterbeer.
Horn is a water quality specialist with the state's Department of Parks and Wildlife. For her, it was a stark, visual reminder of the river's long history of pollution from abandoned mines.
And it immediately tugged on your heartstrings, thinking nothing could live in that.
The mine spill closed down recreation in the river and forced farmers to temporarily shut off irrigation to their crops. But life in the river, it didn't change much. The fish and bugs survived, one crisis averted, until this year.
So I joke that now the river looks like Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory's Chocolate Fudge River.
That's because of a big wildfire that burned about 55,000 acres in the mountains nearby. Now, every time it rains over the burn area, a thick sludge washes into the Animas. Horn says official surveys haven't been done, but it likely killed all the river's fish through town.
You could literally see the fish coming to the banks, gasping for air. It physically smothered their gills and their ability to breathe.
It certainly is unlucky. I mean, it's unlucky now, and it's been unlucky for throughout time, really.
Scott Roberts is with the Mountain Studies Institute, a nonprofit research group based in nearby Silverton. He says the river's facing plenty of problems that don't draw public attention.
It's being stressed by drought. It's being stressed by warmer temperatures. It's being stressed by runoff from wildfire. It's being stressed by elevated metal concentrations. It's being stressed by bacteria, by nutrients.
Certainly the Animas is a bit of a poster child for some of the issues that plague rivers around the western United States.
Ty Churchwell is with Trout Unlimited and lives and works in Durango. We're standing on a pedestrian bridge over the Animas.
But I don't think that the problems that are plaguing the Animas today are unique to the Animas.
In fact, Churchwell says all these issues are increasingly common throughout the West. Drought, ash-laden runoff, and mine pollution are often the norm in watersheds. The Animas has just experienced all of them to the extreme.
So, the shop. We're a fly shop.
And this doesn't make things easy for the local business owners, heavily dependent on tourists rafting and fishing on the Animas. Tom Knopik is co-owner of Duranglers in downtown Durango.
Yeah, it's considered a top fly fishing destination, which mostly is for trout.
He takes solace in knowing that all this trauma is bringing attention to the Animas's myriad problems. Some of the mine waste is now being treated before draining into the river. And at least when it comes to the fire-related sludge, the healing process has already begun.
You know, we don't like it. We'd rather not be dealing with it. But the reality is the Animas will be, in a short period of time, better than it was before the fire.
But it could be another 5 to 10 years before the Animas is back to its former self, according to water quality specialist Barb Horn.
Rivers really are a great metaphor for our body and our own health and our own lives. You can think about maybe the Animas is having a heart attack, a stroke, and clogging up and saying we need to pay attention to what we eat or what we're doing with her and to her.
And she says rivers have been rebounding from drought and floods and fire for millennia. It's just human activity that's made the frequency, duration, and magnitude of those events worse. Luke Runyon, KUNC, Durango.
Another river that's being stressed by warming temperatures is the Colorado River. That's the water source for more than 40 million people in the Southwest. And a new study finds that over the last 100 years, the river's flow has decreased by more than 15%. Colorado State University researcher Brad Udall co-authored the study.
The impacts of temperature are very large on this river, and if you believe temperatures are going to increase, as every reputable scientist now does, you then have to conclude that the future of the river is going to be a future with much less water in it.
Udall says most water managers agree climate change is fundamentally altering how the river functions. Officials in Arizona, California, and Nevada are currently negotiating a new plan to voluntarily cut back how much water they take out of the river. Federal officials have given them an end-of-the-year deadline to craft a plan.
Rocky Mountain National Park has a new tool to help reduce carbon emissions. A solar array went online in July that will offset power in the Trail Ridge store. As KUNC's Desmond O'Boyle reports, building an array at nearly 12,000 feet has its challenges.
Engineers had to compensate for the array to withstand bitter cold and snowdrifts up to 20 feet. The array will provide enough power to offset the current two diesel generators used by the park service. John Hannon is a spokesperson for Rocky. He says the fact the array is above tree line helps.
Yeah, in that regard, it's in a good spot to get the most sun it can. Yeah, there is, as far as we know, there shouldn't be any environmental impact from the system. That's barring something that we don't know or is unforeseen.
The array was built by Zentera, a Colorado-based company that manages the Trail Ridge store and others at national parks across the U.S. The company is building similar solar arrays in national parks to offset its stores there. Structures are being built at Mount Rushmore, the Grand Canyon, and Death Valley National Park. Desmond O'Boyle, KUNC.
New research from the University of Colorado Boulder suggests that if global temperatures continue rising, crop yields will fall further than previously predicted because of insects. As KUNC's Esther Honig reports, bug populations are expected to grow larger and hungrier.
The study found temperate climates like North America and Europe will see the greatest impact. Longer summers will give bug populations more time to breed, and the heat will boost their metabolism and their appetite. Other studies show that each degree in rising temperature brings down crop yield by about 5%. But CU Boulder research professor and co-author Josh Tewksbury says the impact of bugs will double that.
And by adding that, the picture gets worse. particularly in the temperate zone, not so much in the tropics.
If climate change continues on projected trajectories, Tewksbury says we'll be in a very buggy situation by 2050. Esther Honig, KUNC.
We have already covered so much, Erin. How could there possibly be more?
Carly, there's always more. That's what we do.
I guess.
While it used to be known more for its illicit roots, street art has found its way out of the shadows.
The perception of it has definitely changed. I feel like it's coming into a more positive light. But at the same time, some people say that it's maybe watering down that whole scene in a way, just because it's not just graffiti anymore, you know.
Arts reporter Stacey Nick goes in search of street art, which, although these days you might be more likely to find in an art gallery than an alleyway. Plus, for those of us who couldn't get in to the Telluride Film Festival, not that I'm grouchy about it, Howie weighs in on some of the stunning, powerful films that were shown.
But first, walking through forests across the Mountain West, you might not realize you're actually seeing historical artifacts big enough to crush you.
Yikes.
They're ponderosa pine trees that have had their bark peeled off in a special way. As KUNC's Ray Ellen Bichelle reports, the trees are a bit of a mystery to archaeologists, and it's one they're running out of time to solve.
Cassandra Atencio says for tribes like the Southern Ute, these trees are as important as cliff dwellings or stone ruins.
Because we were little and we were nomadic and we weren't like Pueblos and our Navajos. These trees show that we were here.
Atencio is a cultural representative for the Southern Ute Indian tribe. These special ponderosa pines are scattered across the Mountain West, and they all have something in common, a big chunk of bark missing from one side, peeled away by people sometime in the last few hundred years.
This is real. It places our footprint on the landscape as Ute people, as a tribe.
There are a bunch of them here on the edge of a meadow south of the San Juan Mountains.
Humdinger right there.
Archaeologist Mark Mitchell walks up to a gnarled tree about as wide across as two people. Its thick red bark is curling in to reclaim an exposed area that looks a lot like a telephone pole.
We're looking at a place where in the past, Native peoples have removed the outer bark.
He says they did it to get to a spongy white material inside called phloem.
Some people describe it as a little astringent. I think it tastes kind of coconutty.
Mitchell is the research director for a nonprofit archaeology organization called the Paleocultural Research Group. They teamed up with the Forest Service to study trees like this
one. Here's our note taker.
Volunteers start taking measurements and photos. One person starts screwing a hollow pole into the tree, as thin as a drinking straw. This sample will give a date for when the peel happened.
Got it. Perfect.
There are a lot of questions about these peeled trees.
Yes, there are. One of the biggest questions we have is, what precisely was the purpose of the phloem? We know it's edible.
But, he says, were people eating it because it was a delicacy or because they were starving? Or was it medicine or maybe part of a special occasion? Julie Coleman wonders if the trees could reveal patterns about how tribes like the Ute moved across the landscape. She's an archaeologist with the San Juan National Forest.
Yeah. This is a GPS unit. We get point plots on each tree, and then hopefully we'll see a pattern. And, you know, it might show trails and, you know, passageways.
But Mark Mitchell says they're running out of time to study the peeled trees.
We feel like the clock is ticking now. It's been ticking for a while, but we really feel the urgency of it now.
Drought could kill these trees, or an expanding beetle infestation could cripple them with a fungus called blue stain. Or wildfires could erase them.
Some of the big fires that we've had in Colorado in the last 5 or 6 years have taken some of these trees. We know that.
But time could also get them. Some of these trees could be 500 or 600 years old, like this one.
Oh, wow. That is cool. Wow.
That is neat. That is amazing. I was hoping we would find one of these.
For this tree, people didn't just scrape off the edible part. They also pried off 6 planks of wood, presumably to build something, like a traditional cradle board to carry a baby in. That's what it reminded Cassandra Atencio of.
Oh, wow.
Seeing it brought her to tears.
Wow.
Just a couple years ago, she made a cradle board for her grandson.
And I wanted to do his cradle board old school.
She wanted to peel a ponderosa plank for the backboard, but didn't know how. But here was an example right in front of her.
How long has it been since there's been a Ute woman standing here in this spot again? This is really special. And I feel really good.
For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Ray Ellen Bichelle.
KUNC is a member of the Mountain West News Bureau, a regional reporting collaboration, and you can find more of their stories at KUNC.org.
The earliest art features drawings on walls. But since the days of cave painting, that art form has certainly had its ups and downs. Right now in Denver, street art, as it's now called, is on its way up. KUNC Arts reporter Stacy Nick has the story.
While it used to be something that was done under the cover of darkness, street art is now being brought into the light as valid and profitable.
So, thank you all for coming out. This is Denver Graffiti Tour. I'm James. I'll be your guide for at least half of this. This is Aaron, my wife, business partner. She'll be doing the last half.
This summer, James Carlson and Aaron Spradlin have been taking tourists around the streets of Denver.
Anyone want to take a guess what the distinction is between graffiti, street art?
Sanctioned.
Yeah, absolutely. Street art is often sanctioned.
Graffiti, on the other hand, is not. But over the last decade or so, those lines have begun to blur. There are now three tour groups in Denver alone that focus on street art and a myriad of festivals. But it wasn't always that way. When it started 10 years ago, the Denver Urban Arts Fund was all about preventing graffiti.
Yeah, it's kind of a fight fire with fire approach.
That's Michael Chavez. The public art manager for the city of Denver heads up the fund, which pays artists to paint murals at graffiti hotspots.
What we found is if you place murals on walls that are often vandalized, then you kind of take away that canvas for someone to vandalize it. So it's worked really, really well.
And in ways organizers didn't even intend, like putting Denver on the map as a place to see some of the newest up-and-coming talent.
Artists that have done their first murals with us are now doing large commissions all over the country or even traveling internationally.
Like Denver's Lydon Galicia, known by his artist name, Dink, who on this day was working on a piece of art in his home studio in Centennial.
The perception of it has definitely changed. I feel like it's coming into a more positive light. But at the same time, some people say that it's maybe watering down that whole scene in a way, just because it's not just graffiti anymore. You know, it can be insulation, it can be, you know, stencils, it could be stickers, it can range in a whole bunch of different things. So street art, I think, will encompass like all these different mediums, but I think graffiti at its core is always going to be spray cans, markers, bombing, illegal stuff, because that's the roots, that's where it came from.
Growing up in Kansas City, Galicia was drawn to the bold lettering and enigmatic characters created by street artists. But he knew not everyone saw it the way he did.
Obviously, my parents would be like, you know, like, don't go around tagging, like, don't do this, don't do that. But it's part of the culture, you know, it's part of going around and putting your name up and, you know, doing really cool pieces, figuring out a space that's really, really different, you know, getting up like really high or really secretive.
In addition to murals, Galicia also creates custom canvas paintings for fine art shows, along with his own clothing line and merchandise, including toys and buttons.
I am very business-driven, so I always look for opportunities. I like my pieces being displayed publicly, but also at the same time, I have to make a living out of this.
But even as street art comes into its own, as tour guide Aaron Spradlin points out, there will always be those who keep it old school.
This is also called a permission wall. So the difference with a lot of the other art that we've seen is that it's curated. This is just a wall that has a lot of art and it kept getting tagged up, so they've kind of just given in and let people do whatever they want.
Who knows? Maybe that's where the next big thing is getting their start. For KUNC, I'm Stacy Nick.
The Telluride Film Festival took place over last week's Labor Day weekend, and KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz was lucky enough to go.
Where was my invitation?
Mine's missing, too. He says the festival was once again like finding gold in the hills.
As usual, the richness of film on display at this 45th Telluride Film Festival is almost too much to hold in mind all at once. For days afterward, the movies fight for space in the mind. A Colombian picture called Birds of Passage looks at an extended family of indigenous people in northeast Colombia who get involved in the marijuana trade and wind up destroying themselves. It's a fine movie, but it has to yield space to Peterloo, British filmmaker Mike Leigh's historical drama about a massacre of peaceful protesters being starved by Britain's corn laws in 1815. But a couple of other pictures have another level of uncanny power. Canadian filmmaker Rithi Pan received the tribute at this year's festival. As a child, he survived the genocide of the 1970s, when the ghastly Pol Pot and his legions murdered about 1.5 million people. Pan has made a number of films about that time, and his latest, Graves Without a Name, is his search for a way to grieve when there are no bodies and no marked graves, simply pathetic fragments of people and clothing that the living can scrape out of the dirt and the rice paddies. Pan interviews survivors as well as some old toothless men who did the persecuting and the killing. He films Buddhist incantations and all sorts of mystics and mediums who try to locate dead parents, grandparents, and children. Some build models of the killing fields, as they were called, and clay figures of the dead and missing. Pan saw most of his own family die, but in spite of his unrelenting grief, he finds in himself compassion for everyone. And by the end of the deeply sad movie, he says that he's found life rather than death. There's much I did not see at this stunning festival, but another genuinely great film comes from Japanese director and writer Hirozaku Koreeda. His new film, Shoplifters, won the top prize at this year's Cannes Film Festival. Koreeda makes films about families. His work includes Mabarossi, Nobody Knows, and Like Father, Like Son. Koreeda calls this film an investigation into what really constitutes a family. Shoplifters shows a group of people ranging from a grandmother to a 6-year-old girl. They live together in an apartment so cramped it looks like a pile of people. Only 2 of them are actually related by blood. The rest have just found their way to each other. At the start of the film, Osamu, the sort of father, and an 11-year-old boy find a little girl huddling outside in the rain, so they bring her home to become another member of the group. What holds this crew together is their shared poverty and their thieves. They shoplift, steal from cars, lie, and cheat. An early shoplifting lesson for the boy is a marvel of mixed feeling. Father and son bond over a lesson in stealing. Yet they're sweet, and you root for them to survive. They get along well, show genuine affection for each other. So the film asks, are they a family? It's a tough question, and the answer doesn't come until they're fully tested near the end of the movie. 40 years ago, Swiss filmmaker Markus Imhoff made The Boat is Full, about how Switzerland turned away Jewish refugees from Hitler's Germany. Now he's made El Dorado, about African refugees trying to enter Switzerland and other European countries. If such a film can be beautiful, this is. This 45th Telluride Film Festival did not feature many happy films, but the last movie I saw showed that there is in fact greatness and decency in human beings. Werner Herzog's Meeting Gorbachev is an account of a remarkable human being. And Ernst Lubitsch's 1942 To Be or Not to Be is a great comedy, even if it is about the Nazi invasion of Poland.
Howie Mofshevitz teaches in the festival's Student Symposium, a program for college students.
This has been Colorado Edition. Our show this week was made possible by our KUNC members and produced by me, Erin O'Toole.
And me, Carly Huckles. Editors Ashley Jeffcoat and Brian Larson contributed to our show. Ashley also manages digital.
Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Kalatana.
Other music in this episode, Breakfast with Tiffany by Broke for Free, Chad Crouch with Northern Pintail, Jay Blanked with I'm Down, Grimwood by So Far As I Know.
We also heard Warm Body by Peterloo Massacre, and Corporate Presentation and Greenfields by Scott Holmes.
Our outro music is Good Grief by Ryan Little. And if you like what you're hearing, make sure you subscribe so you never miss an episode. We'll be back next week with more great stories for you.
Find Colorado Edition at KUNC.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.